This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Cincinnati's council and the police department are taking steps to crack down on sex trafficking in the city. Council passed two motions yesterday asking administrators to report on new measures the city can take to reduce prostitution. And the city's police department has installed three temporary barricades on McMicken Avenue in an effort to stop sex trafficking. Joining us to discuss the issue are Cincinnati Council Member Yvette Simpson and Police Captain Michael John, who's in charge of District 1. We are recording this portion of today's program, so we're not able to include your calls and emails. Coming up later in the hour, we'll be talking about a Cincinnati Union Bethel program designed to help women get off the streets. But we begin with the representatives from the city. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Councilmember Simpson, let me start with you. This certainly is not a new problem or issue, but why is it getting such attention right now?
So about a year ago, we were approached by the West McMicken community asking us to come in and take a look at an issue that's been going on there for a very long time. They felt that it was getting more pervasive, more aggressive. There were several really bad incidents that were happening in the neighborhood. And so we went up and met with the community. That started a series of community meetings with stakeholders in the community like Off the Streets, Cat House, the End Slavery Group. We even reached out statewide and talk to some folks at the federal government. We've been working over the course of a year to really kind of look at ways, and internally with our departments, to look at ways that we might combat this issue in a more phenomenal way. Because, as you know, it's been going on for a while, and we wanted to be able to shake things up. And so we've been working cooperatively with our police department, Department of Trade and Transportation and Engineering, to look at many ways to look at this issue. We introduced this motion this past week. Is the one-year anniversary of that original motion. And we felt like it was a good time to go back in and say, okay, what can we do now? There was also an intervening event that happened in January. A prostitute was murdered in McMicken. And that really, I think, it got the mayor's attention. It got the community's attention. And it was something that we expected might happen. We knew that it was a very difficult issue. But I think the community started to see, hey, this isn't just the run-of-the-mill activity. This is very dangerous. And so we decided to begin the work of all the studying that we had been doing over the course of the year of all these interesting measures, these very aggressive measures, some controversial measures that we were seeing happen across the country. We started to bring that together in the form of one big comprehensive policy motion for the administration to evaluate and then for council to vote on.
Captain John, obviously the barricade is a visible sign of something taking place. Why was that chosen? And I mean, even council members, people who testified about this on Monday in front of a council committee said it's a drastic measure. So why that drastic measure?
Well, it is a drastic measure, and it is the most visible thing that we've done. And kind of just to piggyback off of what Council Member Simpson said here, this really came to the forefront for me personally back on January 9th. That was the date that Jessica Reveley was murdered on McMicken. And it was also the date that we had a town hall meeting here at District 1. And it was very prevalent with the people that spoke at the town hall meeting that this was a very important subject to them. So I knew coming into District 1 as a brand new captain, this was really the biggest issue that I was going to need to tackle and to really try and get some early momentum built up. So we've kind of taken a 360-degree approach here. One of the first things that I did was actually deploy two officers on foot on McMicken. And the purpose of that was kind of twofold. Firstly, so that the community could see the police were there, we were taking this situation seriously. But secondly, and probably more importantly, it was that the officers were able to engage the community themselves, speak with the women who were on the street, the neighborhood, the businesses, those affected by this problem, and then everything that trickles down from it. And also to try and build an element of trust between the police and the women to try and get them into social services. So with this approach, to build this trust, to try and refer them to all of our social service partners, that was a very important first mark that we did. We've also done call-in sessions, which have really been sponsored by the social service agencies all coming together at once. And the Salvation Army has been very wonderful host for us in that respect. So we can bring the women in, you know, we can put them in touch with all of the needs that they have to try and get them on the right step to change the lifestyle that they find themselves into. Reverse stings is something that we've done as well. Obviously, we want to try and interrupt that cycle of the Johns Patton cruising on McMicken, and that's a way to do that. And so the barricades were really set up somewhat further down the road here, not trying to be to coin a phrase, but specifically we know through our research and our efforts in sting operations that a lot of these Johns cruise the area in a defined pattern. They have a habit of where to go at what time to pick up certain women, and we wanted to make that more difficult for them to interrupt that flow. And also it would form cul-de-sacs on McMicken so people could really take ownership of the street itself.
When was the actual decision made to install the barricades?
We started to come together, I'd say it was in March, and we brought it to the Department of Transportation and Engineering just to see what they would say. We didn't really know if it was something that was that could actually take place. They said yes, they could do that. We felt that was a victory for us, at least on a temporary basis. And it's a 3-month program here that we have the barricades set up.
It is a hardship for some people. I mean, people actually live on the street and they have to come and go. And was that a consideration as well?
Absolutely, we realize it's a hardship to the community. We know it's harder for the Johns. It makes it harder for mm-hmm. our partners within the community. So we brought it to the community councils that were affected. You spoke earlier of the McMicken, the West McMicken Council. We brought it to them, over the Rhine, Pendleton, and they were all very, very supportive. And the business owners have been extremely supportive as well. And we've made some slight modifications to accommodate yellow buses. School's still in session. Metro's been a very good partner for us in actually altering their routes. And again, I think it's a little bit easier for most people to take because it is a temporary condition that McMicken's in. It's not a permanent change.
Councilmember Simpson, there was somebody that testified Monday that acted like she had absolutely no idea this was happening until the barricades went up. And I think you had one of your aides talk to her.
Yes.
Was it just that she was just not paying attention, or was there truly some sort of a breakdown that some folks knew that this was going to happen and others didn't?
You know, you never know. I mean, we've been working with the community councils for a long, long time. And in fact, our motion a year ago addressed the issue of traffic flow. And we had been working with transportation engineering to find a way to reroute traffic, to look at lighting, to look at camera installation. And unfortunately, because of all the development and construction that's happening along MLK, they said it's just really not a good time to think about kind of permanent rerouting of traffic. And so the barricades, again, give us the opportunity to see whether this is actually going to work, and then hopefully over time to be able to find another way to configure the traffic. So we've been involved with the community council. This individual is someone who has come to us several times about a lot of issues, I'll say. Is very vocal on a lot of issues and often takes the position that's opposite from the community council on several issues. And so we're familiar with this person. I did want to make sure I was sensitive to anyone who didn't know, because you just never know how the word gets through. Through community councils and through the community in general. And so I wanted to make sure that people understood, one, that it's very important, two, that there is a possibility that there were certain people who just weren't notified, and we wanted to make sure that we took that into consideration. But the communities were on board with this change.
There is that part of McMicken that goes from Straight Street all the way down to where it's blocked off now at Martin Luther King that people can still get access to by Marshall.
Right.
Is there any kind of concern that it's just going to push them up that way? I mean, they've already been there.
Right. Well, we realize displacement is obviously something that is likely to happen, and we're already seeing the signs of displacement. But when you look at problem solving in general, usually when you have displacement, where it's displaced, it's a reduced level of activity. So it's very important for us to keep that open line of communication with the community so we know where it's being displaced and we can redeploy our resources, you know, to combat what they're seeing. It's very important to us. One of the things that we felt it was very important was to involve all the safety people involved in this. So fire department were a very good partner for us in really telling us exactly where those barricades were going to be placed, so it wasn't going to affect emergency response.
Is this the first time this has ever been done in Cincinnati with the barricades?
It's not the first time it's been done with barricades. We've done it at on 13th Street. At Green and Race, we've put barricades up. It might be the first time we've done it for prostitution, but to combat drug trafficking and the vehicular flow of people that that are purchasing drugs, we've definitely used it with some success.
Now, you talk about the ideas here to disrupt the normal pattern. So I know, like, when you set up OVI checkpoints, you know, those are announced, you know where they're at, and then so sometimes they put patrols on the other routes around that. So if somebody knows, well, I can't go that way because I'm going to get caught in the checkpoint, then you've got officers over there looking for them on another route. Do you have that same setup here that, you know, is there another obvious route? If they can't use McMicken, let's go here, and you're also monitoring that?
Yes. I mean, overall, the officers that I initially put on foot patrol have been involved in every process that we've put in place. So, yes, specifically, his name is Specialist Nate Young, Officer Katie Werner, and I also have to give credit to Officer Lisa Johnson, who's worked really tirelessly on this effort for many years. They are very much engaged in monitoring exactly what this traffic flow is going to look like with these barricades in place.
I wanted to follow up. You mentioned Officer Lisa Johnson. You gave her high praise at Monday's committee meeting. What does she do that is making a difference?
I mean, she has been so ingrained in that community. She's like a part of the family there, actually. She knows the women. She spends time with them. She took our office on a ride-along through there. She actually applies for grant funding on her own to try to find more services, to provide more services for the women. She came to me. We have a lack of access to appropriate number of beds at the Cat House. So if women are come and they're on drugs, they can't go to office the streets, they have to go to the Cat House first. Well, the Cat House has a limited number of beds, and so she's been applying for grant resources for that. So she's really a part of this community. She cares a lot. She gives a lot of time, and I think they consider her one of them. I mean, she really has spent that much time there.
We are talking about Cincinnati's crackdown on sex trafficking in the city. Our guests are Councilmember Yvette Simpson and Police Captain Michael John, who commands District 1. We are taping this segment of the program, so we're not able to include your calls or emails. Is there any, this may be premature, but is there any possibility that these barricades could become permanent?
Well, that's a decision that's outside of my pay grade. Let's see how it's working for the 3-month experiment, really. I think that's really going to tell us how effective they are.
So it could, but I guess that's something you'd look at, that it's successful for these 3 months. They come down, the problem's right back, and then I guess that's policy decision from council. Do we do something different here and make these permanent?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think when we first kind of looked into this and had the conversation with transportation and engineering, and let me give full credit to CPD for taking that action, because we hadn't even thought of barricades. We thought, okay, let's do a study. Let's see what the traffic flow looks like. Let's watch it. Let's see what happens with the construction along MLK. And once that is finalized, then we can look at rerouting traffic, redirecting traffic through McMicken. This gives us an opportunity in our transportation department, an opportunity to really watch this along with CPD to figure out whether or not there needs to be more permanent changes to the flow of that street, whether that is a permanent, you know, closure of parts of the street or whether that's redirection. Remember, we're also looking at lighting, additional lighting in certain areas. This will be helpful for us to figure out whether there's certain spots where we want to put that, and then installation of cameras.
Was this the worst spot in the city? Are there other areas that are concerning as well?
No, this was by far and away the worst spot. And one of the things I did after that town hall meeting on January 9th was ask our crime analysts to actually look at the calls for service that we receive specifically regarding this type of activity. And the McMicken corridor really was the focal point for not just District 1 and District 5, but really the entire city.
And do you have any reason why?
I really can't put my finger on the reason why. Just historically, it has been labeled that way. There are some blog websites where, in fact, Johns communicate between each other, and they mention McMicken a lot in their blogging.
With when a John is arrested, And I think you had a reverse sting this week.
We did.
Take me through the what are they charged with? And I know Officer Johnson talked about this on Monday at the committee meeting, that they are eager to plead out to like a disorderly conduct charge. Walk me through that process.
Well, absolutely. It's more beneficial for them if they plea out to a disorderly conduct. They're going to be charged with a solicitation for solicitation. But in addition to a criminal charge, they're also subject to civil penalties in regard to their vehicle. We will seize the vehicle as a civil penalty. They have to go through a process to get their vehicle back. And obviously, to go through a trial is somewhat disturbing for an individual. And really, it crosses every single socioeconomic barrier. When you look at the men that are involved in this type of activity, it's not just one particular group of individuals.
And it's also people coming over from Kentucky, too. I mean, there's a whole lot of them from Kentucky are cruising that street.
Yes, it's not just a local problem in terms of who it's drawing
upon. It's kind of a regional problem.
It is a regional problem. And something that we find very alarming is the fact that we've had a number of rape offenses that have originated from McMicken in 2014. And in fact, one of the individuals we just picked up this week on that reverse sting was a registered sexual offender. So we know it has the potential to bring in violent individuals. Obviously, that was definitely the case with the homicide of Jessica. But we are concerned that you have a street in the city of Cincinnati that is drawing potentially violent people into the area.
Councilmember Simpson, talk about you approved, council, you didn't approve, council approved two motions this week. Walk us through the purpose of both motions.
So one of the motions is really to kind of look at certain measures that we already have in place, records. We're trying to really get a sense of how are certain plea deals used, how are people charged. We're trying to get a sense of how the system currently kind of treats these offenders, and then also get an update on some of the measures that we requested before. So that's one of the motions. And then the one that's getting lots of attention, is looking into the feasibility of several initiatives that we've seen across the country, and whether or not they would work here, and if we were to implement them, what would the stages look like? And so the one that's getting the most attention, I think, right now is the John notification, meaning publishing the names, and also the spousal notification with an arrest or conviction and a positive STD HIV result. And so, but there's also other things we're requesting. Stay away orders. We've seen those work in other communities. Whether or not that will work here, we don't know. You know, increasing the fine, doubling the fine. Also vehicle owner notification. So one of the things that Officer John was talking about was the fact that if it's someone's vehicle, it gets impounded. But if you're driving someone else's vehicle, we can't impound it. But we can, and we've seen it happen in other communities. Dayton is a good example, where you get a letter from the police department saying, okay, hey, your vehicle was used in the commission of a crime. You know, I don't know if you know this, but we want to notify you of that. So what it's doing really is bringing, they call it shaming. I don't see it that way. We don't see it as punitive. It's one of those things where we want to bring people out of the shadows, and hopefully it will work as a deterrent. Because one of the things that these individuals kind of thrive on is the ability to remain anonymous.
How would the publishing work? I mean, where would it be published? How
actually,
who would see it?
We've seen an example in Dayton where they actually just put it on their website with addresses.
Mm-hmm.
In
the
our
police
city,
department website.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're talking about is just publishing the names, providing it on public access, and then giving that over to the media for them to publish it. We've seen in some cities purchase billboards and put license plate numbers and names on billboards. We're not ready to go there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's something to think about where we've seen. So many, many cities have used this method in many different ways. Again, we're starting, I think, pretty slowly. You know, these are individuals. These are public records. So we don't worry about constitutional issues. But that's the way we want to see it happen. And we don't anticipate publishing addresses either. That's not something that we anticipate.
Are there any changes in state law that need to take place in terms of, you know, punishing Johns?
Well, one of the things we want to do and this is probably more relative to PIMPS but could apply to Johns, and this was a great recommendation that actually came from the committee, and we've kind of gotten to flesh it out. But, you know, we believe that if a woman is under the control of a pimp, you know, we can read the language of the state and federal statute to believe that that's human trafficking. And to add a human trafficking charge to every local offense could really mean additional penalties for these individuals. And we think that that would mean that they would take it much more seriously.
And is it your experience that most of these women are working for pimps?
Yes. I mean, that's what we believe. We've seen some. So one of the benefits of having a prostitution court, and that's one of the things that we really hope happens in the county, is that you have a very a place to put all this. You can measure. You can see Franklin County Catch Court, which is up in Columbus. They've been doing this for a while. And they actually, that data comes from them, that 90% of the individuals who come through are under the control of some sort of coercion, which would be defined as human trafficking. And we've seen that a lot of other places, that those numbers are consistent with some other records that we've seen. We'll be able to get a better measure of what it is here once I think we have a dedicated court and a way to measure this a little bit more closely.
How would these new penalties work, though? Again, it's an issue that, you know, in some situations, some lower-level offenses, the county jail has a revolving door. You take them in, they come right back out. So how does the jail situation play into what you're trying to do here?
Well, it's very important. In fact, Judge Heather Russell has actually approached the Ohio Supreme Court specifically on the idea of having a prostitution court here in Hamilton County, and she's met with all the other municipal court judges on this subject. But it's very important to recognize that for the women, incarceration is not the answer. It's absolutely not the answer at all. Most of them, unfortunately, are drug dependent. A lot of them are really broken women. Some of them have come from abusive types of backgrounds. So they really need acceptance within the social services. That's really where we can provide them help and a way to really rebuild their lives. And it's something that's going to take some time for a lot of these women. It's not something that can happen in 2 weeks. Or the sentence that somebody would spend in a jail cell. That's not a way to reclaim these women. So it's very, very important that they get put into some kind of a system where they're able to receive all of these social services that are available right now.
Councilmember Simpson, What do you say to the people, and there are people who believe this, that this is a victimless crime?
I would say that they're absolutely wrong, right? I've heard individuals say, well, these are two consenting adults. Well, the person who's doing the act hasn't consented, right? The consent is between the individual pimp and the person who's the John, and the woman often is forced, right? So that she's not the one giving the consent. So it's our belief, you know, particularly when someone, and we know, I mean, we've researched this, we've seen videos and documentaries all across the country about how these women are treated, the amount of control that pimps use over these women. They don't have a choice, right? They've been brought into this through many different means, some kidnapped, some brought through, you know, through drugs or alcohol gateway. Some people, you know, very young runaways are, you know, brought into this life, lots of different ways. But what we know is that these women, because they're under a certain degree of control, they are victims. I mean, they're under serious control, and so they're not consenting to this behavior. Long gone are the days, and I don't even know whether even then you could say that there were a lot of women who were doing this because, you know, they could make a choice. But long gone are the days where women were doing this as sex work. I think in our community, we have very few women who are engaging in sex work. There are some communities where that's more active, areas like Nevada, where they have legalized prostitution. We see it in other countries as well. Here, we don't believe that's the case.
You shook your head when Howard asked that question about a victimless crime. Do you want to add something to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if you met any of these women on the street and asked them, is this a choice to be in this lifestyle, they'd all say no. So how can you say it's a victimless crime if they don't want to be in this cycle? It's tragic circumstances. So absolutely, there's no way you could call it a victimless crime.
Councilmember Simpson, in your research, is there some place in the United States that gets this right?
You know, what we've seen is a lot of different measures that are employed by cities to help abate it. I don't know that there is, quote unquote, a magic pill or a series of magic pills. I think there are a lot of conditions that can create more and more of this type of activity. We are concerned. I know I'm sure the CPD is concerned that the heroin epidemic is going to increase the rate of this activity. For areas that have less of a drug issue, this might not be as pervasive an issue. I think in our community, Ohio being a hotbed for trafficking in general, you know, we're the fifth in the nation for human trafficking. 88% of that trafficking is sex trafficking. We know that a lot of this stuff runs up and down state lines. And as you said, Howard, across the bridge, I mean, it's very pervasive for us. So what we've seen and what we've compiled, we believe, is some of the best practices that have been employed, you know, across the country. But I don't think that we've seen, quote unquote, a model. I think places where they have a prostitution court, where they have access to social services, where they have cooperation between the police department and the community and these social services, I think they work really well.
I, of course, work for a radio station, but I do listen to other radio stations. Some might find that surprising. But I know this week you were on a major AM station here in town with a rather flamboyant host. We won't name names, but, I mean, he makes no apologies. Just make it legal. Well, and I'm sure he probably brought that up when he was talking.
He did.
So why not make it legal?
Well, one of the things that I shared with him, and he even agreed, believe it or not, was that
progress.
was that even where you have a legalized prostitution, there is still a black market, and people are still being traded, right? Because people will pay maybe a high dollar to have individual women who are part of, say, a bunny ranch, if you will, and they are, you know, tested every couple of days, and they're highly paid, and, you know, some areas they're unionized, they have representation, they negotiate for wages and benefits. They're still in places like Vegas. Women who are brought in, who are, you know, it's not $200, it's $50. So we know that even if you legalize it, there's always going to be a market for sex trading, someone who's going to try to do it cheaply and take advantage of people. So I don't think that that eradicates the issue at all.
So what happens now with your motions were passed yesterday by council? What's the process moving forward?
Well, I think it's a good sign that we had unanimous support for this, right? I think that there could have been more debate about it, about whether we need to do anything differently. We need to let the police department continue what they're doing and not make any policy changes. The fact that we unanimously agreed that we need to look at this is a good sign. So the administration has 60 days to come back to us with kind of, I think, a way forward for each of these options. And then to give us, okay, here's kind of the con, here's the pro. If you want to do it, here's how you go forward. And then the council will have the opportunity to vote, you know, up or down, ordinances, resolutions. There'll be a combination of things because some of this requires the cooperation of the local courts and others. And so we'll have many different ways to show our support for this. Now, of course, we were talking about doubling the fine. That's something that we can do by ordinance. And hopefully that will be the low-hanging fruit for us. But there are other measures that I think will take a little bit more finessing, I'll say.
Captain John, I'll give you the final word. With these barriers now on McMicken, is this something that your department is looking at every day, you review once a week? I mean, what's your strategy going forward here? Where this is a 90-day program, we're somewhat into that. So what happens through the rest of this period?
Well, we're looking at it every single day and multiple times a day as well. And I said it earlier, the most important thing for us is feedback from the community. What are they seeing? How effective is it? Because they're there all the time. We can be there for a few minutes every couple of hours, but that doesn't really tell the whole picture. So it's very, very important for us to keep that line of communication open. And my thanks goes out to the support we've had. It's just been overwhelming. And we are extremely grateful that they provided us this opportunity to try this measure.
We've been talking about Cincinnati's crackdown on sex trafficking in the city. Our guests were Councilmember Yvette Simpson and Police Captain Michael John. Coming up after a short break, we'll hear about a Cincinnati Union Bethel program designed to help women get off the streets. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.